Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Genetics Podcast. I'm really excited to be here today with two returning guests, with James Beck, the Chief Scientific Officer of the Parkinson's Foundation, and Nacho Mata, who's a professor at the Cleveland Clinic and coordinator of the Latin America Research Consortium on the Genetics of Parkinson's Disease, also known by the acronym LARGE-PD. We're going to continue a discussion that we started back in 2021 for episode 69, where we talked a little bit about the genetics of Parkinson's disease and the future of personalized medicine in this field. And I'm really happy to say that this team has been continuing to do incredible work over the last few years. We talked about the PD generation study that they've been leading the charge on, and we're going to talk about some of the impacts of that study so far, but also the future and some of the big changes that are coming that I know I'm really excited about, and I think many others in the Parkinson's and neurodegeneration genetics field more broadly are going to be excited about. So James and Nacho, thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, pleasure.
James, I was wondering if you could maybe give a quick overview of some of the progress that you've had with PD generation. I think you've sequenced, you provide testing and counseling now to more than 13,000 people, which is a pretty staggering number. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the goals, you know, maybe the first phase of the program, if we want to call it that, to this point, and a little bit about what you all have achieved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have to say, recruitment has been going like gangbusters. We are probably going to crest 15,000 and very shortly in this month of March in 2024. So it's really quite remarkable, the progress we've made as far as that goes. I think one of the key things, lessons to take away from this study is, first, there's a tremendous interest in people with Parkinson's to know their genetic status. Do they have that genetic link to Parkinson's, and how might it affect them and their families as part of it? Also, from a scientific basis, I think is really interesting is we're identifying about 13% of the individuals we are sequencing have a genetic link, monogenetic link to Parkinson's disease. And if you look at people who may have certain risk factors that might lead to a higher genetic association, they might be Ashkenazi Jewish background, they've got young onset, they've got a family history, that certainly rises to about 18% of individuals have a genetic form of Parkinson's disease. But if you take that group aside, those high-risk individuals, if you will, and just look at basically the general population, which at this point we're approximating. It's not never meant to be an epidemiological study, but it is an all comers. So we're finding about 9% of people have a reportable mutation that's linked to Parkinson's disease as part of our testing. And so what's really exciting about that is if you're a pharmaceutical company thinking about, you know, precision medicine within the Parkinson's disease space, it's viable. I mean, there's a significant population there that will likely test positive and could make a market, which we hope, and see some progress at arresting this neurodegenerative disease.
Yeah, absolutely. What have you learned about attitudes of neurologists, movement disorder clinics, healthcare providers throughout the program? Because I think it's probably fair to say that when you started versus where you are today, the field has probably changed a lot. What have you heard from working with doctors that have been part of the program?
So what we've heard, we started out just trying to get a sense of where the community was, looking at neurologists and expert neurologists who study in Parkinson's disease. And there was some apprehension, even amongst expert neurologists, about, you know, people would rate themselves on a scale of like 1 to 10, about a 5, in the comfort about returning results back. Mm-hmm. So I think some of that still exists to a certain extent, although as we've expanded and been able to bring in more sites and offer additional materials and support along the realm of genetic counseling, for instance, I think physicians are beginning to become slowly more comfortable with this. Certainly, it's not something they do on the day-to-day, and what we've recognized is that they need support. So we've worked with our colleagues at Indiana University, who've been fantastic group of genetic counselors in the Parkinson's space, to put together materials that we're trying to make available broadly so that clinicians who may be interested in this can have some reference material so they can know how to have that conversation with people with Parkinson's. You know, the other thing we've learned, and this is something that it's really interesting, is we talk about, you know, partnering more closely with Nacho and his group with Large PD. The idea of genetic counselors is not something that's common elsewhere in the world. It really seems to be, you know, largely unique to North America healthcare system and maybe some other parts. And so it's really important that clinicians get that understanding and that comfort and know how to return results back to participants. And I think that's really a key driver, too, of the recruitment we've seen is that, unlike most clinical trials where someone participates in, even observational ones, they don't get anything back. And so here, results are returned back, and those results can be impactful to the individual, to their families, as part of the process.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's a great segue, Nacho, to hear a little bit more about Large PD and some of the work that you've done more broadly in the genetics of Parkinson's disease. Maybe you could just give a quick intro to yourself and your background and talk a little bit about that collaboration that you've been helping lead from the Large PD side.
Sure. Yeah. So I think in the field, and again, if there's a lot of people here that know a lot about genetics, they'll agree with me that, you know, in the past 20 years or so, there's been a lack of representation in genetic studies. You know, most of the studies, especially larger studies like GWAS and those kind of things, you know, have been done mostly in European-derived individuals. It means that, you know, a large part of the world we don't know much about in terms of like risk factors, especially genetic risk factors. So, you know, about, you know, 15 years ago, and thanks to actually the Parkinson's Foundation that believed in, you know, in our project and believed that they needed to be a better representation of all the populations in genetic studies, you know, we managed to create this consortia. You know, we started with a few, you know, small size, trying to recruit samples here and there to try to really understand what the genes that we were finding in European populations, if they were represented, we were seeing the same variants, different variants, and really understanding or trying to characterize the genetic component of the Parkinson's disease in these populations. And, you know, it started organically growing. More people wanted to be part of it. As Jim said, not only patients want to know, but I think a lot of clinicians want to know if their patients also have a genetic form of Parkinson's disease. First, because, you know, it can tell you perhaps a little bit of the prognosis. You know, as we know more about some of these genetic forms, we know that they behave differently, they progress differently. They might not look very different, but, you know, in terms of long term, sometimes they're very different. There are different phenotypes that they might present. So I think neurologists wanted to know, and I think that's how the consortia kind of grew from the interest of the clinicians to try to understand this. And then, you know, one of the things that was lacking for all these years, you know, we've been doing a lot of studies, really, again, studying the known genes in Latinos and seeing, you know, that some of the mutations that we saw in Europe, they're also in Latin America, which makes sense because, you know, part of their genomes come from Europe, but a lot of them are not as frequent as you would expect. We've also found new variants, for example, in GBA. We've nominated new genes through GWAS. So we're starting to understand a little bit better. But one of the things that, you know, has been lacking was for us to be able to return this data back to the patients. And, you know, one of the reasons is because, obviously, as Jim said, there's no genetic counselors. And a lot of the times the neurologist doesn't really have a good grasp of what the results mean. But also on our part, technically, you know, when you do a research study, the quality control is not the same. You will always want to validate these variants through a genetic testing, a CLIA certified laboratory to make sure that, you know, because it's not the same to publish data on a cohort of individuals that actually return individual data or individual results to an individual. You want to make sure that that is the right person that you're giving the result to. And there's a lot of steps that need to happen. And I think PD Generation has been leading the way on this. And as we learn more about that, you know, obviously one of the wishes that we always wanted was to be able to bring this to first Latinos in the UH, which we've done. There's been a great recruitment for PD Generation for non-Europeans as well, but also being able to bring that to other parts of the world where this is needed. And I think, as Jim said, it's important for many reasons. One, because the patients want to know, but also I think the field is changing a lot with, you know, ongoing clinical trials that are moving some of them from phase one to phase two or phase two to phase three, where, you know, we need to know who is carrying these variants to make, you know, these clinical trials available to them and really have a large enough cohort and a diverse cohort to be able to understand what the outcomes are of this for any individual, regardless of what their ethnic or ancestry is. So,
yeah, and I'd love to talk a little bit more about where we go from here and how to make programs like these even more inclusive and representative. But I also just wanted to ask about the return of results process in Latin America, for example. In the absence of genetic counselors, what does that process look like? And what do you think it should look like? Is it a goal that we should have to create the genetic counseling profession in other parts of the world? Or is it actually that the rest of the world can learn about the way return of results is done in Latin America, for example, and meet somewhere in the middle? What have you learned?
Right. No, so So in our case, you know, we have 46 centers in 14 different countries. Every country is different in terms of the things that you can do that the ethical committees, the IRBs will allow you to do, but also the resources that they have. I would say most of our sites is the neurologist, the one that is returning the results right now. Luckily for us, a lot of them have been working long enough with us, you know, some of them more than 15 years that they really understand the genetics for, you know, from me giving talks and papers that we've written. I think a lot of them really understand it, which makes it a little bit easier. Some of them use medical geneticists. So there are actually doctors that have a little bit of training on genetics that sometimes can provide this. And in fact, I have one of them in my lab now doing a PhD, and he was doing this in Colombia. But I think, you know, the gold standard should be, I think, what we do here. I think you need to have a person that is really well-trained, not only to understand the results, but also to know how to give it to the patients, you know? And this is important, not only post-testing, but also pre-testing. I think one of the biggest things is that, especially when you're dealing with, you know, populations that maybe the are not very well-versed on science and genetics, and they don't, sometimes they might not even understand what getting the results themselves mean. Not only the point mutation, but understanding that, oh, okay, so if I carry a variant, now my descendants have 50% of chance of carrying the same variant, and now you're putting somebody that might be in their 20s or 30s at a 50% chance to carry the same variant that one of their parents does. And I think this can potentially have a lot of, you know, issues within the family, right? And I think that's why the pretesting is so important, to make sure that, you know, whoever is going to receive the results or the family, sometimes even the family in general, understands what this whole process is and really decides on their own with all the knowledge if they want to receive that result or not. And then again, as I said, giving the result in a way that makes sense. You know, we've seen a lot of cases in which the person has received a negative result and then automatically thought that means that they don't have Parkinson's because they received a negative genetic result. So again, you really need to have a person that can return that results in a way that the patient will understand what it means, and also sometimes respond some of the questions that the patient might have on, again, implications for the family members, and all that stuff. So I think the gold standard should be this. I don't know if all the hospitals are going to have enough resources to be able to have a genetic counselor on site to be able to do this. But I think we need to find ways to bring that gold standard as close as we can to these sites. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do through PD Generation is training. I think with training, I think individuals that are interested and have the knowledge in genetics might be able to do this process well. So I think that's one of the things that we're exploring. And I think we're going to test a couple of different things and see what works and then go from there. Yeah.
Just to put a fine point on what Nacho was saying, I mean, not only do people think if they test negative, they always almost invariably ask, does that mean I don't have Parkinson's? But it's important to understand, and this is where the counseling aspect comes into, what was tested and what was not tested. So, and we see this here in the US, but elsewhere, where someone may go through just a very simple chip-based test, and that's only looking at one or two hotspots and think, I don't have a genetic link coming from this. When in fact, when you do what we're doing, you know, the whole exome of these specific genes and really able to identify individual variants that may not get picked up on a chip, but through, you know, next generation sequencing backbone, we find them. That's an entirely different ballgame. Also, the other thing to keep in mind is that we're not reporting all variants back to participants. We're only reporting variants that are significant variants. And the reason is we want to make certain that, you know, again, given that there is a limited understanding of genetics amongst the population, there's no need to burden them with things that, you know, scientifically we're uncertain about. But we want to be able to go back and get in touch with them. And that's something we can do through our study to let them know that, well, you know, science has changed and now this variant is a significant variant as part of that process. And, you know, it's critical to the, you know, the understanding of these results, and so that people with Parkinson's can act on them. And as Nacho said, and which is maybe obvious to everyone here, but when you talk about genetics, you're not just talking about a person, you're talking about a family. And the implication of genetics is really broad. And you especially see that, I think, in people from the Latin American region where they have strong family relationships. And those discussions about health care seem to really involve, you know, the family as part of that. And so you're not just dealing with one individual, but you're often dealing with a group of people. What I hear about from the genetic counselors that, you know, there's a lot of folks on the call who are interested in the outcomes of their testing.
Yeah, and Jim brings a good point because, you know, when you're dealing with non-European individuals, you know, the variants of unknown significance that we call, right? Those variants that we don't really know what they mean and we don't report back to the patients, they're much higher because there's a lot less that we know about this population. So sometimes those mutations or those pathogenic variants might be important for a certain population, but because the lack of representation in public databases, we don't report those because we don't know exactly what they mean just yet. So I think the likelihood of finding one of those in an individual that is non-European is higher. So that difficults the return of results and what a negative result might mean for somebody that is non-white or white non-Hispanic. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in how you've taken all these learnings and how you're going to take it from here. We've talked about potential changes in sequencing technology, broadening and trying to increase accessibility. There's also, I suppose, process changes that you might have learned. And you're probably making these tweaks along the way. How do we introduce a better counseling experience, a better return of results experience? Maybe you can talk a little bit about the next phase for the program and what you all are hoping to focus on. Maybe Jim, if we start with you, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say that, you know, we've reached this 15,000 milestone shortly, you know, thanks to a lot of the generosity and philanthropy of the Parkinson's community. Our next phase is through the generosity of Aligning Science Across Parkinson's. They've given the foundation a significant grant as part of this through the Global Parkinson's Genetics Program. And that's where we're able to really take this to, I think, to the next level, really increase the outreach, particularly in trying to incorporate Latin America within the PD generation study in a way that we haven't really been able to heretofore. One of the key things is we're moving from using a targeted exome to whole genome sequencing as part of the process. And a goal here is really to increase the efficiency overall of this process. From the outset, our PD generation study has been sharing DNA on the back end and, you know, the BAM and VCF files with research collaborators as part of that. They've been limited. We do a targeted exome, so it's about 4,700 genes through our genetic testing lab, Fulgent Genetics. But, you know, moving forward, by providing the, you know, whole genome sequencing data, the idea is to just minimize how often that DNA sample gets handled and just be able to get the data directly into the hands of the GP2 team, which Nacho is part of, in order to really analyze that. When it comes to the operational side of things, we're still, I think, as Nacho's pointed out, there's a lot of different countries and a lot of different ways with which to do it. And so our approach is recognizing that we don't have the be-all and end-all. What we have is a template that's worked well in the US and trying to provide those materials in a way that can be appropriate for various jurisdictions. From the beginning, PD generation has been a study that's been in both English and Spanish. So we have a lot of materials already in Spanish, which is helpful. But, you know, I'd like to think about expanding worldwide. And I know one of the, you know, goals that we have through our GP2 partnership is to think about how do we return results globally? And again, what templates can we generate so that these results can be shared with people maybe from Lagos to Kuala Lumpur? You know, again, I think, as Nacho pointed out, a lot of neurologists, maybe some medical geneticists are involved in the process. But there's an approach on how to return results. And it's not that it's incredibly difficult, but, you know, it still needs to be learned, and understanding the steps and appreciating what kind of questions might come through from patients and their families are something to be considered. So really thinking about how to template these such that they can be useful elsewhere in the world and setting up opportunities through training. You know, GP2 and the Parkinson's Foundation have what are called learning management systems, basically online training that people can access here in the US for CME through the foundation or elsewhere just to gain that knowledge in order to really understand how to do that. So those are, I think, just a couple ways with which that, you know, change the operations and through the whole genome sequencing and these return of results as part of it. And I think I'll stop there. Nacho, I don't know if you want to add anything about our change, especially how we're going to be looking to get involved with the LATAM region.
Yeah, I think becoming global is the next goal. I think PD Generation has been so successful in doing this. And again, I don't think Jim actually mentioned that they've reached this almost 2 years ahead of time. So, you know, all the calculations that they had in terms of when they were going to be able to reach those 15,000, you know, they've been like completely swapped. And that is having in consideration that we went through a pandemic, you know, right at the beginning of the project. So, I mean, it is incredible. And I think is giving a lot of people in the field and outside of the field really a way to be able to do this in a way that, you know, can be successful. Obviously, there's a lot of logistical nightmares, you know, that come with it, because it's not as easy to do in some of the, you know, the countries that we want to reach. And also, you know, although we're used to do research, you know, the protocols are very different. And going to whole genome sequencing, for example, you know, some of our sites use saliva kits, for example, to extract DNA. That's not going to be longer an option if we want to do whole genome sequencing, because we require better and larger amounts of DNA. Also, you know, we used to, our sites, for example, are used to collecting, you know, hundreds of patients and then send them all together. And that doesn't work with a CLIA certified lab where, you know, each sample has to be sent individually. So I think there's a lot of things that we're working. Hopefully, I think, again, moving into Latin America will be just a pilot study of how this can be taken to other parts of the world, as Jim said. And then the other, you know, thing that we are considering now, we're planning on, is what is going to be returned back to the patients. There's new genes coming up, there's new variants coming up. So all that has to be evaluated and decide, okay, well, this is returnable, this is not returnable. And now, also with the moving of whole genome sequencing, there's also incidental findings that we have to deal with, right? What happens if you find a mutation in a gene, like the BRCA gene for a cancer, you know, that has to be also returned. So I think there's a lot of things to think about. And then working together with, you know, pharma as well to see how everything that is being developed and all the knowledge that we're gaining, how we can get ready, you know, for those clinical trials, and how we can have like clinical trial cohort ready, right? So people that are well phenotype, well genotype, you know, to be able to move the field forward and really try to get closer to better treatments or a cure, which is, you know, what we all hope for. So
yeah, absolutely. It's just interesting too. You bring up a good point. I forgot to mention the, you know, so with the exome, you can get by with saliva. We've been using buccal swab in the U.S. A lot of our participants are able to participate virtually and, you know, have a consenting session, counseling session just like this. But with the move to whole genome sequencing, the failure rate of buccal swab is like 25% or higher. Saliva is maybe 10%. But so we really need to use blood as part of the process. And, you know, it varies based upon localities. I know in Latin America, there people are coming into the clinic, so, you know, phlebotomy is an option. But here in the U.S., as we're looking to expand not only, you know, within Latin America, but also in North America, we're looking to switch to an at-home blood collection kit, which would be really, I think, very, very interesting to see. So this is a little kit. Looks like, you know, the easy button on Staples. And if you see those commercials, the big red button you put on the side, it's the lancet, sterile lancet, which will draw through suction about a milliliter of blood. So it's very easy to do at home, hopefully easy with a particular population, you know, people with Parkinson's, they have it's a movement disorder. So
is it the Tasso kit? Yeah. I've seen them before. Yeah.
Yeah. They work great. And we're really excited about it. Cause you know, the other way is like a little lancet, and it's just so hard to push when you're an elderly population. This seems a much easier and painless process.
And you get blood all over your kitchen. It's messy. It's not nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Lancets are tough. So this is a much easier approach from this. And then, you know, that trial ready cohort, you know, we've seen this happen second time already. Biogen, you know, just has, I think, shut down their LRRK2 targeted trial. Before that, it was Genzyme. So Denali, I think, is still going to try to push forward. They've been able to get third party to provide some significant funding as part of this process. And so our hope is that, you know, at the very least, we can give them a jump start on identifying individuals who, in this particular case, are looking for LRRK2 mutations. But I mean, that is ultimately a goal, is to be able to, you know, one of the goals of PD Generation certainly is to not only empower people with Parkinson's, but to facilitate these clinical trials as part of the process. And by letting people know they have a genetic mutation, we hope that they will then say, I will act upon that and enroll in these trials and really make a difference for everybody with PD.
I was curious about the countries, the Latin American countries that you're going to start in. I think you mentioned a couple of pilots. Where will you start, and how did you pick the countries? Because I know you've 46 sites across 14 countries. You probably have a lot of experience. Where are you starting?
Yeah, so we're still trying to decide. We're looking at resources, IRB. Also, some of the countries have very strict criteria to get blood out. Again, DNA, when it's extracted locally and then shipped somewhere outside of the country, is a lot easier because it's not considered a biological sample, while blood is. So we're evaluating every single factor to see which ones are going to be the easiest. I think we have lots of centers in Mexico that could potentially be, Colombia, Peru. We're some of the ones that we've collaborated for a long time, and we kind of have all the kinks already worked out, and we kind of know how to do it. But yeah, at the end, it's going to come out to, because we're trying to start this as quick as possible, trying to see which ones are going to facilitate that just to get it going. And then once we have a process in place, I think we'll try to expand as to as many centers as possible. Yeah.
Yeah. We hope to get like three different countries and three different sites up and going. And then, as Nacho said, it's the logistics. I mean, before we get all 40 plus sites up, we want to make certain, can samples get to the US okay? Can we, process them? Do we have a database in place for the clinicians to enter, securely patient information, so we can, again, track all this stuff. And I think once we get over those hurdles, which hope to be soon, I mean, we have a couple sites we hope to have online this month and begin to start that process. We can, fingers crossed, go by the summer and really start looking at a couple more sites. But, regulatory aspects remain a big hurdle, and they're different for every country, and they can be as difficult as they are in the US, where we have one site in the US, we've had a protocol we've amended for almost a year and still waiting for their IRB to review it. And we've already moved on to the next protocol for all the other sites. So it's just these little things on regulatory aspects are important, I appreciate, but they can be headaches when you're trying to do things fast.
Yeah, yeah. And as I mentioned before, they're different to the research part, right? So now there's a CLIA certified lab, the sample goes somewhere else, there's full genome sequencing, there is genetic counseling involved. So they're even trying to use the protocols that we already have in place for research, there's a lot of amendments that need to happen in order to be able to do everything that we want to do. So, and all the data is going to be through the Global Parkinson's Genetic Program, the GP2 program that Jim was mentioning. All the data is going to be available for researchers in the field to be able to analyze. So that's another sharing component. Everything is going to be in a database. I think there's a lot of items that need to be reviewed and make sure that everything looks good. So yeah.
Yeah, I was also curious about one of the comments that you made right towards the top of the show, Jim, about the estimates around the percentage of, I think, the general population that carry Parkinson's risk variants. I'd love if you could give just a quick crash course on the couple of major genes that we know about. They're not completely penetrant, but some of them are highly significant impacts on risk, right? And I'd love to just have a little bit of a conversation about how this program might pave the way for prediction, prevention, screening programs. You talked a little bit about paving the way for pharma and biotech companies that want to run precision medicine studies or are already running them in some of these genetic subtypes. And I think there's a natural follow-on here, as we've seen in ALS, for example. Biogen had tofersen approved for symptomatic SOD1 ALS patients, and now they've been running a global prevention trial in SOD1 ALS patients. And I see, as probably the way you see, is a similar opportunity here to go from treating symptomatic patients to moving a little bit earlier in the process. But I'd love to hear a little bit about how you think about it, because it's a much bigger scale. We're talking about 9% of the population potentially at risk, and there are other factors that come into whether that genotype becomes the phenotype or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to be clear, 9% of people with Parkinson's. So that overall population with PD is smaller. Maybe 1 to 2% will develop PD, and 9% of those will probably have a genetic form. So, with Nacho on the line, I'll feel somewhat foolish trying to educate around genetics, but I can get it started and then hand it off to Nacho as part of the process. And so, what we're seeing as results for the genetic testing is, by and far, GBA1 is the predominant gene we're finding mutations in. About 7.5% of individuals will have that. And as through our whole exome sequencing, we have 40 plus different variants that have been, a significant variants that have been found, plus a bunch of unknown variants. about 2.5% of people tested have a LRRK2 mutation. On top of that, we have a fair number of individuals with a Parkin mutation, which is somewhat surprising, although most of those are heterozygous, so they have just one allele with a mutation, and then we have a number of homozygous compound hets that are mixed in there, so it's a smaller number of that, maybe it's about 1%. And then, again, we have a 7-gene panel, just right. So we've LRRK GBA, LRRK2, Parkin. The other genes we're testing are SNCA, VPS35, PINK1, and PARK7, and so those, we've tested nearly 15,000 people. We're still at single digits. You know, and when it comes to alpha-synuclein, we're only finding individuals with duplications. So no A53T mutations, for instance, that we've identified so far. And so I think, you know, there are two dozen different genes associated with Parkinson's disease, maybe on a monogenic level. We're really hitting the top ones. It just drops off very fast. And so when it comes to, and there's a practical side to that. So when you're providing CLIA genetic testing and counseling, reports need to be generated with this. And so if you're constantly generating reports on negative results, that adds up resources and time. So just, you know, I feel confident that we are hitting the necessary genes. It's certainly ones that we think when you look at the pharma landscape where, you know, next generation therapies are being prepared for, these are the ones that are probably top of mind as far as preclinical efforts and, you know, early clinical stage efforts as part of that process. Nacho, do you want to talk into any details about?
No, you did great. I think there were no surprises there. I thought we were expecting GBA to be the top, and then followed by LRRK2. That's kind of like what we know from, you know, the studies that have been published. Yeah, the Parkin was a little bit high, but there's quite a few, you know, early onset patients in there as well. People that, you know, have a tendency to participate more in genetic research because right. they think that they might have some genetics in there. And luckily for us, you know, the top two genes are also the genes that pharma is working on, you know, clinical trials. So I think that's, you know, it kind of matches very well where we're the cohorts that we're targeting on. I think this changes a little bit population by population. And I think, you know, once we start expanding, we'll see that maybe things are a little bit different. In Africa, there was a paper that came out a few months ago, yeah, with a new variant, and that's going to increase the number of GBA1s probably that we see in Africa. So yeah, I didn't think that it was, you know, very surprising the results of what we're seeing, and I think it kind of matches what we were expecting, which is also good because you want to make sure that this is a good representation, you know, of the population and try to, you know, determine how frequent, you know, some of these variants are, and you know, you can even look at pockets as Jim said, you know, there are certain populations like Ashkenazi Jews where the frequency might be a little bit elevated, so you can really identify places where you might want to target, you know, clinical trial or where you're going to get a good number of patients in there. In Colombia, for example, just speaking about Latin America, there's also a specific variant that is only in Colombia that doubles the number of by patients with Parkinson's disease with GBA variants is close to 10%. So if I had a drug, you know, that I wanted to target GBA1 and I wanted to move to Latin America, that was probably the place that I would go. And I think, you know, once we move global, I think we'll be able to identify certain places where, you know, it will make sense to bring my resources and do this trial. So, yeah.
I think it's not a focus for this next phase, but how do you all think about expanding testing out to family members? For example, the 9% of people who are GBA or LRRK2, a natural question for a family member is how should I be thinking about this? What do you all think about that?
I think that is certainly the next step. I mean, there's no question about it. As we think about prevention trials and where to go next, we will need to identify these individuals. You know, people with Parkinson's are typically in their 60s, so they have children. If they have children, they're going to be maybe 20s or 30s, you know, and so they're not quite at age to be, you know, developing Parkinson's by and large. So, you know, as we make progress and hopefully see some of these precision medicines make some headway, then we can start going back and trying to reach out to these individuals. But I think, you know, ultimately, if we have a hit on a particular drug, I think it'll just change the field totally. Where, you know, we're not at the genetic testing foundation. I mean, our goal is to be able to help stimulate the field and get it going, but get to a point where it becomes self-sustaining. Where you know, there is a medicine that's successful, and then everyone routinely gets tested as part of the process. And then we can, you know, I think focus on those who are at risk, the family members.
Yeah, I think this is probably the question that probably genetic counselors that work at the PDG get the most after a positive result. It's like, well, you know, what do I do with my family members? And if they tell them, you know, family members will be contacting the Parkinson's Foundation to see, oh, how can I get tested too, right? So I think this is important. It brings, you know, one of the biggest things here is that genetic counseling becomes a lot much harder in individuals that do not have the disease currently, because assessing the risk of a variant, even for variants that we know are pathogenic, we, like, for example, LRRK2, right? We consider it as a high penetrant gene, but there are still people, you know, that they will make it to the 80s and 90s with showing any symptoms. So, you know, I don't think as a field we understand enough about some of these variants and some of the modifiers that might help us predict who is going to actually develop or when they're going to develop the disease or not. So, you know, I would feel like a genetic counselors will have a much harder time to explain to a family member what a positive result might mean to them specifically. But I think, again, I think it's fair to say that a family member, you know, if their mom or dad, you know, has got a positive result, like, if they want to know, there has to be a mechanism for them to know. Again, with a genetic counseling and explaining exactly what it is that we know and what we don't know, what this means for them. Because, yeah, I think, as Jim said, you know, a lot of clinical trials, if we have a something that works, we might want to target people before they even show any symptoms. And I think having those individuals identified will be critical to be able to have this, again, clinical trial cohort, ready cohorts that we can then use. So I think this is a tricky situation where, again, we're, as a field, we're still trying to decide how we're going to deal with it. But I think it's something that we have to think about, because obviously, as Jim said, especially in Latin America, you know, these results are shared amongst the family, and it creates a lot of anxiety, and we have to give them, you know, some kind of way to deal with this. So I think, yeah, it is going to become very important as we test more and more people and more of these results, you know, come out. So
yeah, I just say that the complexity around the counseling, I think, is really the main barrier for doing this now, for instance. I mean, we certainly have had these questions come in, and we've talked about it internally, not just on our steering committee, as we've kind of laid out, like, what it would take in order for this to do. And it is not trivial. I mean, it's a whole nother, it will probably make PDG look trivial comparison once we start looking at at-risk populations. That genetic counseling session, it's the pre-counseling, which is as important as the post-test counseling. So the pre-counseling is important too, because, you know, this is an area where you need to look before you leap. Genetic testing, the knowledge you derive from it, you can't, you know, unknow something. And there's some people who just don't want to know, and that is great. And, you know, they'll deal with it when the time comes, but other people really want to know. So you don't want to force people into this situation. You want to give them that choice, because it's a, you know, once you go down that path, you can't go backwards on it. And then the risk factors, you know, LRRK2, I mean, not sure, what is it, about 30% of individuals who have a LRRK2 mutation, say G2019S, might develop Parkinson's. It'll vary based upon your ethnicity, but, you know, that's hard for people to process. I mean, if I told you that there's a 30% chance of showers today, you probably wouldn't even leave with an umbrella. But, you know, when you think about, you know, the chance of getting disease, it could really cause some anxiety on it. And so people have a hard time processing that. Humans are terrible with averages and percent chances. So it's one of these things that we'll just need to address. I know there are, through our genetic testing lab, they have a commercial offering, which will do the exact same test that we're doing right now, targeted exome. So for people who want to know, it's a picture aware PD, but, you know, it's not cheap. It's like, you know, several hundred dollars part of the process. And the counseling is included as part of, if they have a positive hit, but, you know, just always want to make certain that people have a positive experience as a result of this, because it is not just one person, it's the family, and it can be impactful. And we hope the impact will be that could mean that they could take a medicine that will prevent them from developing PD overall, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, I think that's the key. And this is why perhaps it slowed us down, you know, in the last 10 years or so in terms of genetic testing and genetic counseling in the US, because, you know, a lot of neurologists didn't see the benefit of really doing this for the patients if they didn't have anything to give them. And said, you're positive, and then take this, you know, and this will help you. Now with the ongoing clinical trials, I think that has opened up the field a little bit more in terms of, oh, now there's something I can offer to my patient, and said, hey, well, now you have this, maybe you can participate in one of these studies with, you know, individuals that do not have the disease just yet. You know, there's nothing you can give them, or there's anything that you can tell them to prevent or you know, slow down the progression if they are going to develop Parkinson's disease. So, you know, something that I tell patients when I give talks to them and they're worried about their family members is I always say, look, if you have somebody in your family that has Parkinson's disease, you know, there's these environmental factors that we know increase your risk. Try to avoid them as much as possible. There's nothing you can do but the genetics, unfortunately, right now. Right. So at least, you know, try to eat healthy, exercise, you know, the things that we tell everybody, even without our genetic testing. If you have a family history, you know, you need to take care of some of these things. So I think it's important to consider this and remember again that we don't have all the knowledge yet. And it's really hard to really make sense of some of these results, especially for undiagnosed or asymptomatic individuals. So, yeah.
Two quick questions to close out on. One was, you mentioned some of these really important clinical programs like the Denali program. What are the one or two that you all are really keeping an eye on to say if these go the right way, they can really crack open a big opportunity for the field? But also on the flip side, we have to be careful that if enrollment is a problem or if there are safety or efficacy issues, that it also could be a setback. I guess the Denali and Biogen one is in that group. What other ones are really important here in terms of coming up in the next couple of years where we may get some answers on what works here?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I've signed a lot of CDAs, so I can't really be certain what I can tell you or I can't tell. But I will say that within the LRRK2 space, there are a couple companies that are doing this and some others in the wings, and certainly within GBA as well. So just encourage people to, you know, to Google this and they can find out the information so I won't get in trouble. But to say that there are a number of companies that are in the wings that are thinking about this and are looking to make a difference. What's really interesting that some of them are taking, you know, a broader approach and recognizing that, you know, based upon the biology we know already. So for instance, you know, looking at LRRK2 and GBA, for instance, LRRK2, when it's mutated, it's an enzyme that becomes overactive. And we think that plays a pivotal role in the pathogenesis of Parkinson's disease. There are people who don't have a genetic mutation in LRRK2, yet still have elevated levels of LRRK2. Could a medication which benefits those with the genetic form help those with a non-genetic form, just elevated levels of LRRK2? Similarly with GBA, you know, the mutation prevents typically proper folding and processing of the enzyme out to its target in the lysozyme. So there are individuals who don't have a genetic link to GBA or mutation in the gene still have low levels of that enzyme as well, the GCase enzyme. So are they potentially to benefit as well from some molecule which will help with folding or increase the amount of GCase that gets targeted? So these are, I think, areas where we can see the advantage of broad testing, you know, as well as where we could potentially go in the field in precision medicine. I mean, it was in, you know, cystic fibrosis where, you know, Vertex came up with a targeted precision medicine, helped a really small number. Maybe it was like 3% or 5% of people with cystic fibrosis. And, you know, that's the first therapy, which is great, the first cure. Now they have a combination therapy, essentially helps 90% of people with cystic fibrosis. So I think that's where we'll see progress in Parkinson's disease is certainly targeting those with a clear genetic form of Parkinson's and then broadening that to help a broader pool who may fit within, you know, certain qualifications to gain access to that therapy.
My last question here was just about community engagement and recruitment. And you said something that's very rare in clinical research, which is we finish 2 years ahead of time rather than 2 years behind. What did you learn from that? Why were you very pessimistic with your initial projections, or did something go really well that would others in the space would benefit from learning from how you all did this engagement with the community or recruitment or otherwise?
Yeah, I think, and Nacho can certainly chime in here too, because he's part of our advisory panel for outreach amongst the Spanish-speaking population in the U.S. I think one, which just I think surprised a lot of people, there's just a tremendous interest in knowing this genetic link. You know, knowing about one's genes is maybe a perennial question, hence the success of a bunch of ancestry.coms and things like that, where it shouldn't be surprising that it persists across groups as part of that. So that was certainly the interest of the patient population. Education is a key thing, I think, as part of it. So we've worked closely, certainly within the Spanish-speaking community, to provide materials which are appropriate for that culture, and in a language that hasn't been terribly translated. It's gone through some decent translations part of the process, so it doesn't look like it's just a Google translation, and ensuring that we have that outreach and connection there as part of it. It's also to recognize that when you look at different communities, there's diversity within those communities. There's people who are ready to go. You offer them genetic testing and they're ready to go, and there are others who are a little more reticent. And this is where the education comes into play as far in order to get the real deeper penetration. And I think that's where we are with some of our studies. So within the Hispanic population, we've been able to achieve about 11% of our participants identify as Hispanic, Spanish speakers as part of the process, which is fantastic. We haven't had that same success amongst Black and African-American community. We're only for about 2% of participants, 2.5% are identified as Black and African-American. And, why is that? And so there's certainly a long history there that can go with it, but I think, we just need greater education and outreach, not only about what PD generation is doing, but what about research participation is doing, why that's important, how it advances the field. So there's a broad groundwork that my colleagues are working on as part of this, just to ensure that we can continue this outreach into the community. Because ultimately, while it is good, you could say from a society standpoint to be inclusive, certainly scientifically, it's really important as part of this process. I mean, one of the goals behind the GP2 program is to have 150,000 PD genomes to really understand the genetic architecture of Parkinson's in ways we haven't done before. And I think they're on progress maybe to reach closer to 200,000 because they've got a lot of cohorts sort of coming in. But that diversity is really important to better understand Parkinson's. Why is it that, on an epidemiology level, people who are identified as Black or African American have a lower prevalence and incidence of Parkinson's than Caucasian individuals? Access to care could play a role, but you look at within the U.S. people who identify as Hispanic often have similar barriers to access to care, and they have a significantly higher prevalence than the African American community. So genetics may play a role to this, and this is certainly where we can really hopefully understand.
Yeah, I think something just to add to this is that something that the foundation did really well. So these prediction models of when they were going to reach the 15,000 was also based on the first phase of APD generation, where the research was more centralized. So they have 8-10 centers across the country where people could go participate. And I think part because of COVID, and also part because everybody that lived very far away from any of those centers were saying, how can we participate? Like, this is not fair, but they didn't feel included on this. And they did something that I've been advocating even in research, which is bringing the researcher, in this case, genetic testing, to the people, and not asking the people to go to certain centers and participate. And I think when they open up this and facilitated really the process of how somebody could enroll from anywhere in the U.S., as he said, sending saliva kits or saliva swap, vocal swap kits to people's houses and be able to participate that way, I think, the enrollment per month, it skyrocketed because, again, as he said, the interest was there. It's just that the first approach perhaps was not the best one in terms of being able to be inclusive and make sure that anybody that wanted to participate, would participate. And again, I think everything went from mouth to mouth. Everybody wanted to participate, and I think that has been the recipe for success. And I think there's something that we need to learn here in research. And I've been advocating for this for a long time. Is that not all the patients that want to participate in research live near a big center where research is being done. And I think we need to find more ways to bring this to the patients and facilitate participation, regardless of where they are physically or even the resources that they have to be able to travel, you know, an hour or 2 hours to a big center and park and spend a whole day doing a research business. So I think he's been a great example of how this can be done and how research can be brought to the entire community, which has been awesome, to be part of.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations to you both and the whole team behind you on the great progress here. I think it's fair to say that you're doing incredible work, and it sounds like there's just chapter one here. There's many more great things to go. So thanks for taking the time as well to share all the learnings with everyone. This kind of thing, I think, is invaluable for anyone who's thinking about starting a genetic testing program, if they're thinking about how to make their research more inclusive, or just want to understand a little bit more about the genetics of this really, really significant disease to so many of us and our families. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick.
Thank you.